This is an iHeart podcast.
This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Another hour of the Jesse Kelly Show on a Tuesday. And I'm warning you now, we're done with politics for a bit. I don't know how long it's going to take me. This is not going to be a multi-part series. So however long it takes me, it might be a half hour. I doubt that. Might be an hour, hopefully. Might be more. We're going to go talk about a very important part of history that may apply to you and your family, something people don't know about, a lot of people don't know about. We will get back to politics when that's done, and we'll make fun of dirty communists in Hollywood and this idiot woman police chief in Cincinnati and get to other emails. But we get emails all the time on this show, and funny ones, great ones, bad ones, insulting ones, it doesn't matter, right? But we have had a lot. We have had a lot of ones that touch us in one way or another. And this is one of those ones. In fact, Chris, if you don't mind, I should have told you this beforehand, email this guy and let him know we did it when we're done with it. I have the email right here. I'm going to give it to you. Okay. So we got this email a while back. And it, well, I'll read it for you. This was in August. Dear Jesse, I would like to respectfully request that you consider doing a history segment on the bridge over the River Kwai. My grandfather served in the British Army as part of the artillery and was later captured by the Japanese. He spent over 3 years as a prisoner of war, repeatedly forced to rebuild the bridge after Allied bombings. The stories he shared were both horrific and tragic, yet they also reflected extraordinary resilience and courage in the face of unimaginable hardship. Sadly, about 10 years ago, he took his own life following the sudden loss of his son, my father, as the combined weight of grief and his wartime memories became too much to bear. I know your focus is primarily on American history, but if you could share even a brief mention of this chapter in history, it would mean a great deal to me and my family. And says I can say his name. I don't want to read his whole name, but his name is Brandon. So Brandon, if you are listening now, we are about to tell this tale. It doesn't just apply to Britain. This is in a British story, an Australian story, a Dutch story, an American story, an Asian story. But this is a very, very ugly part of history that a lot of people don't know. How ugly is this part of history? I watched an interview as I was just doing some research and cobbling together some things so I could tell you this little tale. I watched an interview with a very, very, very old man, had to be pushing 100. So old, you know, you could tell he was just hunched over, old, just very old, very old. And he said the worst nightmare he ever had about this time period was 10 days ago. I don't know when it was filmed, but it wasn't that long ago. 10 days ago. He's got to be pushing 100, wakes up, drenched in sweat, night terror. How traumatic does something have to be for you to go through it when you're 20 and wake up with a horrible nightmare 80 years later? How horrible, how traumatic does something have to be? So let's talk about that something. This is the story of the Railway of Death, the Death Railway, the Burma-Siam Railway, and this is a World War II tale about resilience, Japanese captivity, barbarism. It's a tough tale, all right? Now, let's clarify a couple things right off the bat. Burma. Where is that? That doesn't exist anymore. Siam. Where is that? It doesn't exist anymore. The modern day country of Thailand that was known as Siam back in the day. All right? Siam. So when I say Siam, we're talking Thailand. In fact, just for ease of knowing this, of remembering this, I'm probably just going to refer to it as Thailand so I don't confuse people. What is Burma? Myanmar, depending on how you pronounce it, it's a country right next to Thailand. Now, I want to give you, in case you're driving, not looking at a map, you're welcome to look at a map. It'll help you, as always. But if you're driving, don't worry about it. I want to give you an idea of where these places are on the planet, because it's going to matter a lot for our story. In fact, we have to do a lot of background here. You know where Vietnam is. You can at least identify roughly, oh, that's Southeast Asia. Okay, so you have in this big peninsula, there's a big peninsula where Vietnam is on the total east side of it. There is Cambodia in this place. There is Laos in this place. There's Thailand in this place. There's Myanmar in this place. This is where it's all taking place. Now, what is happening? Okay. The Japanese Empire leading up to WW2. We've talked about it many times. I'm not going to go into all of the background. They were now a modern country. They had modernized. They were extremely militaristic, a country that really prioritized and valued its military history, all that samurai Bushido code stuff. Really cool history, to be honest with you. But they became a country run by its military. That's a dangerous place to be. Dudes love the idea of that, at least briefly. This is a very guy-centric thing. The country run by the military kind of sounds cool because we respect the military. Oh, sweet. It'll be tough. It'll be disciplined. They'll have shiny boots. But you really don't ever want your country run by the military, because people generally, you ever heard the saying, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail? You ever heard that saying? It's a great saying. It's very true. Whatever you've got in your tool belt, whatever your thing is, you are going to look at everything as an opportunity to use your thing to solve it. If you're a great talker, you're extremely charismatic. No matter what the situation is, in business, maybe you're trying to chat up a dime at the local park, trying to take her out on a date, you're going to use your charm, your words, to try to win her over. If you're in a bar and things start to get hairy, you'll probably crack a joke, buy somebody a beer. It's what you have in your tool belt. When you become a country run by the military, everything is going to simply have a military solution. Hey, we're Japan. We have a pretty tough population, pretty tough military. What we don't have is stuff. We don't have resources. We need some. You know who has a lot? Mainland Asia. China. Thailand, Myanmar, India, they're going to play a big role in this, or at least the reason behind it. They have all kinds of stuff. And it's weird when you study any point in history, it's funny to me, at least I've always found it funny, how often things come back to the same place. You know, this is one of these things that's ancient. This area is just rich in stuff. Spices and rubber and oil and all the things people love, things people need for various reasons. There's always going to be a war there, always going to be a conflict there. Japan starts to expand. They invade China. You already know most of this. They invade China. They start working their way through Asia. That's Vietnam. That's Thailand. That's Myanmar. Heading to India. They're taking Singapore. They want the stuff. Now, that works for a while. The problem with Japan, the problem Japan was going to run into, and they knew they were going to run into it, is supplying troops with the things they need. The old saying we've repeated 1,000 times on the show, it's a saying from a Marine, amateurs study tactics, professionals study logistics. is so true. It doesn't matter how great your army is. You can have the shiniest, most brand new rifles, even today, drones and tanks and planes, and everything's good. You can have the best trained troop. They're all Navy SEALs. You know what it means if they can't eat and don't have any bullets? Nothing. It means nothing. They're going to starve to death. The planes will never get off the ground. It means nothing. You must supply your troops. That is a difficult thing when we're talking about islands, the Pacific Ocean, the Navy comes into play. Japan needed a solution. We'll talk about that in a moment. Before we talk about that solution, let me talk to you about Relief Factor. Now, Relief Factor is something that is near to my heart because I am so anti-drug. And I'm not just talking about fentanyl. I don't like taking things. I always feel like it's bad for you. There's always something terrible for you. So chronic pain, though, what do you do about that? You can't just live like this. So you take something. Maybe it's something over the counter. Maybe it's something the doctor prescribed. Try a supplement. Try Relief Factor, 100% drug-free supplement. You're in pain because of inflammation. You need to attack the root of it. That's what Relief Factor does. Every day you take it, it works better and better and better. Go to relieffactor.com or call 1-800-4-RELIEF. We'll be back.
The Jesse Kelly Show.
I like it.
Returns next.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a fantastic Tuesday. Remember, you can email us, jesse@jessekellyshow.com. If you miss any part of the show, you can download it, iHeart, Spotify, iTunes. And we are doing history right now on, it's the Railway of Death, the Burma-Siam Railway. Now, and I need to clarify something before I continue. Jewish producer Chris asked me during the break, the bridge over the River Kwai, was that something that was real? Was it just the name of a movie? Okay, so the movie, it's a very famous movie. The movie came from a book. The book was a work of fiction that had all kinds of reality in it, all right? So the author of the book took real stories of the men who lived through this, cobbled together a Air Fingers quote, fictional novel, and then they made a fictional movie over it. But there was a River Kwai, and there was a bridge over it. I'm just telling you now the real tale of what happened and what, gosh, so many thousands of people died during, all right? Now, back to what we were discussing. Japan needs the resources. Japan invades China. Japan starts storming through Asia and taking things away, not just from America. Remember, they took the Philippines from us. They're taking things away from the British. And this is happening at a speed the Allied countries were simply not prepared for. We had a military presence in the Philippines. It was not enough. The Japanese simply stormed in faster, more fierce than we were ready for. They took the Philippines. They took a lot of prisoners. We'll come back to that. The same thing is happening in these other Asian places. Many of them are controlled by the British Empire, namely Singapore. Well, Singapore is a big one. Remember, Britain at this point in time controls India as well. Now, Singapore was thought to be the jewel of the British Empire, and it was thought to be untakeable. It's fortified, surely. That turned out to be a complete joke. I have read many things from Brits who were there, British soldiers who were there, and to a man, they talk about how lame their training was, how lame their equipment was. It just sounds to me, listening to these guys, they were a very complacent British Empire, not at all ready for an aggressive, well-trained, fierce Japanese force. Now, before we go any further in this, I need to talk about the Japanese force itself and their mentality. You already are aware, because we've talked about it many times, they saw themselves as samurai, warriors. That is how they saw themselves. Their officers carried samurai swords. They had contests on how many heads you could chop off of living prisoners with your samurai sword. They saw themselves as samurai, so that was part of their culture, military culture. Now let's discuss their military training itself. I have read and watched testimony from Japanese soldiers at this time. They were part of the Japanese military. And they talked about wanting to kill themselves during their boot camp. That's how brutal it was. Brutal in a variety of ways. One of the ways you read about this consistently over and over and over again with the Japanese military at this time, they love to hit. Hitting, slapping, punching, kicking, it's just what they did. And I know that that's something that occurs in militaries around the planet, occasionally here, occasionally there. This is a daily occurrence at this point in time in the Japanese military. If you have people above you, they will slap you. They will hit you. It's not just screaming at you and go do some push-ups. They'll kick you. They will hurt you physically. And it's not limited by higher-ups. If you are above anyone else in ranks, in rank, in the military, you will slap, kick, and punch the people underneath you. It was considered to be an important part of their military training. You get slapped, you get kicked, you get punched, and you in turn will slap, kick, and punch the people underneath you. I'm not trying to make excuses, but I am trying to drive home the point. Physically abusing people you have power over was part of their culture. It was woven into every part of their culture. They believed in hitting, kicking, slapping, punching. It is what they did. In fact, it's part of what sparked such a vicious guerrilla movement in the Philippines. The Japanese took the Philippines from us, and there was all kinds of amazing Filipino resistance. The Filipinos have something deep against getting slapped. No one likes to get slapped, but for them, it was like a mortal offense. And the Japanese were always slapping them. The second you slap somebody, well, now he's going to join the resistance and he's going to shoot you next chance he gets. It's just kind of how it was. So that is part of it. There is another part of it. The idea of surrendering, of becoming a prisoner. We'll talk about that in a moment. Before we talk about that, as long as we're talking about Asia, let's talk about bamboo. You ever heard of bamboo sheets? You know why Cozy Earth is getting so big and so famous so fast? It's all this bamboo that they use. The sheets, they're like silky soft, but they're also stretchy and they breathe. So they're hypoallergenic. If you have sensitive skin, they're wonderful for it. I sleep hot. I can sleep in these and I don't roast. They are so confident in their sheets. You get to try them for 100 nights risk-free. 100 nights. They're practically daring you to send them back. That's Cozy Earth. Visit CozyEarth.com. Use my code Jesse for 20% off. That's CozyEarth.com, code Jesse. And if you get a post-purchase survey, let them know you heard about Cozy Earth from Jesse Kelly. Because home isn't just where you live, it's how you feel. Let's go home with Cozy Earth. Back to the story. Next.
Truth. Attitude. Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a fantastic Tuesday. Stepping away from politics for a few to do a little history on the death railway. Back to what we were discussing. This is post-WW2. We're discussing the conduct of the Japanese military right now, and I was talking about their training, how they hit each other, slap each other, kick each other all the time. This is what they believe in. There's another part of it, though. They believed. It was part of their culture. Well, there are a couple big parts of it. First, they believed that a true warrior is never taken prisoner, ever. Mothers instructed their sons to kill themselves before being taken prisoner. Now, how culturally ingrained was this? Because remember, we talk about it all the time. Nothing is more powerful than culture in a society. It's way more powerful than laws. What was the culture? So much of Japan is rural, like most places. Rural is the majority, right? Small little villages. That's so much of Japan. Let's say Ab and I were Japanese in 1940. And let's say our oldest son, James, goes off to war for the Japanese military. And he gets captured alive. He is captured alive by the Allies. You would think that would be a relief for Ab and I to find out he is alive. Well, praise God, he was not killed. Praise God, he's alive. Let's hope he returns to us one day safely. Nope. In fact, we would be in physical danger in the village where we live. This is a small village where everyone leans on each other. You're buying this and that. I could very well tonight in my Japanese village, leaving my work, I could very well be jumped by the men in the village and beaten to death or severely maimed because my son disgraced the family by being captured alive. That happened to people in Japan. That was the culture. That's how against being captured alive was. Now combine that with the slapping, the kicking, the punching, with the final thing here, and that's the feelings of racial superiority. I know that your dirtball history professor taught you that white people are the only ones who've ever been racist in history. They're the only ones who've ever oppressed anyone else on the color of their skin. But sadly, your history professor was a dirtball America-hating communist who doesn't know anything about history at all. All peoples in history, from time to time, have felt they're racially superior to other peoples. This happens all the time. Yeah, I know. Well, the Nazis, the Japanese were just as racist as the Nazis. They not only felt they were superior to all other Asian people, they felt they were superior to all white people. And by the way, the white people at this point in time felt that they were far superior to the Japanese, referred to them as gooks and monkeys and all kinds. This was the world. It's how all peoples are, how all peoples operated. The Japanese felt that people below them, the Chinese especially, were rats, dogs. They referred to them as these things. And like I said, they really felt they were racially superior to the Caucasian, mainly Caucasian powers they were fighting. Britain, Australia, America, the Dutch, these people. All right. Now that's the background on the culture. They start storming through Asia. Like I said, Thailand, Vietnam, Myanmar, India, the Japanese are beating us up and they're taking away things. They're taking Singapore. They're taking these things. At the same time this is happening, something bad is happening to Japan. Their naval superiority they had at the very beginning of the war is starting to go away. The Allies, not just us, but a lot of it is us, the Allies are building up their navies, building up their expertise, and the Japanese Navy, which was good, but limited because they couldn't replace the ships, the Japanese Navy was starting to get pounded at sea. They were losing ground. Well, I already said, look at the map. Japan's an island. You have all these troops in Thailand. You have these troops in India. How are you getting them bombs and bullets? How are you getting them medicine, clothes, food? I don't care how samurai they are. They have to eat. They have to have something to shoot. They have to have, you see what I mean? You have to supply them. Well, this is where they borrowed something, an idea from the British. the British had had an idea that they rightly dismissed, which credit to them for dismissing it, but they had had an idea before, and the idea was, what if we built a railroad? What if we built a railroad? It's essentially 300 miles or 400 kilometers. I don't know what exactly the conversion. I know they kept saying 400 kilometers. I didn't look it up. I'm an American. I don't deal in kilometers. But it was a 400-kilometer railroad running essentially from Thailand, connecting Thailand and Myanmar. A railroad. A railroad that cuts directly through some of the thickest, most hostile jungle on planet Earth. Every disease, every poisonous snake, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, spiders the size of your hand. Inhospitable doesn't describe this portion. In fact, to this day, much of what we're discussing here is still not inhabited. There are villages here and villages there, but even with the modern technology we have today, even with modern medicine that we have today, so much of this stuff is just back to being jungle. No one wants to live there. I mean, like I said, there are villages, there are people around, but not a lot. Britain looks at the project, and this is what they came up with. They said, if we try to build this railroad, this is before World War II, if we try to build this railroad, it's going to take us 5 years. We think it's going to take us 5 years. They did kind of a cost-benefit analysis thing. And this is a very, they were a very modern, very sharp empire back in the day. And they said, the juice is not worth the squeeze. Too many people are going to die here. We can't, it's just not, it's not, drop it. Just drop the whole thing. So they dropped it. Japan, facing trouble on the high seas, steps up and says, you know what? I like this British plan. But here's the problem. This is already 1942. The war is already just beginning to break against Japan. Japan doesn't have 5 years. They can't have a five-year plan. It's not just that they need this railroad built. They need this railroad built now. They need it completed, and they need it completed quickly. Now, here's why it gets so ugly. Combine everything I already told you about the brutality of the Japanese military and their culture and all that, the racial superiority stuff, all that. Combine that with the fact they're sitting on tens of thousands, honestly, over 100,000 Allied prisoners of war. These people are in their possession. Japan looks at them as lesser, lower. Already they think they're scummy because they got captured. So Japan says, well, if we got to do it, and we got to do it fast, we've got an army of slaves we can use. We'll continue in a moment.
Jesse Kelly. Back soon.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful, wonderful Tuesday. You can email the show, jesse@jessekellyshow.com. In case you're wondering if I'm going to wrap up this history story in 10 minutes, the answer to that question is most definitely no. She's stretching on a little bit. I don't know how deep it'll go in the next hour. We'll get back to politics at some point, but we're telling the story of the Allied POWs building the Railway of Death in WW2 across some of the worst, most inhospitable jungle on the planet. So that was the setup. That was the why. That was the idea. Japan needs a railroad. Japan needs a long railroad. They need it built through the jungle where there is currently nothing. They need it hacked through the jungle, and they don't have 5 years. They need it fast, because their troops are going to start starving to death very, very quickly. Now, let me explain how you may have found yourself if you were a Brit, if you were an Aussie, if you were an American, if you were the Dutch. This is how you may have found yourself working in hell. Let's say
let's say you were in the Navy. Maybe the British Navy, maybe the American Navy. Same story applies to both. I've heard plenty. Boom. Torpedo slams into the side of your ship at night. Things are on fire. Things are smoky. You are below deck. And the ship is in such bad shape, the ship has lost power. You can't see. You are choking on the smoke. You have to find a way to get up on top of the ship so you can get out, because the ship is now disabled and the Japanese Navy, they're shelling it so they can send it to the bottom of the ocean. You manage, by the grace of God, to get clear to the top of the ship. You get out, you jump into the water. You start to swim. Lord willing, you find something that floats, maybe a life jacket. You remember, you are alone. It's at night. You're alone in the ocean. God knows how many of your friends are now dead, and you're watching the flashes as the Japanese military is sending your ship to the bottom of the ocean. But wait, I bet you thought it couldn't get worse. Oh, it most definitely can. After the noise of the ship shelling dies down, you begin to hear screams, the screams of men, followed by gunfire. What's going on? The Japanese are now in smaller boats, cruising around where the ship went down, machine gunning the survivors in the water to ensure there aren't any. And you hear a Japanese boat approaching you. By the way, this is some guy's true story. Otto Schwartz, I think, is his name. The Japanese boat begins to approach you. You think you're about to die. You lay your head to the side and play dead as they pull up beside you, chattering in Japanese, poking you with a stick to see if you're worth the bullets it will take to machine gun you. By the grace of God, well, maybe. They decide not to. They decide you're already dead, and they motor off to machine gun more of your friends. You start swimming. You are exhausted. You are frightened. You're thirsty. You're hungry. And you eventually find your way onto the shore. But you see, the Japanese are taking all these territories. Because you've swam to the shore doesn't mean you're out of the woods. You have jumped right out of the frying pan and right into the fire. The Japanese are already on the beach with some of your friends. They decided not to machine gun, and they immediately hold you at gunpoint and start beating on you for fun. Then they decide, well, we have a railroad to build. We've got another slave here. Let's get him to where we need him to go. Where are they going to send you first? They're going to send you to something known to history now as a hell ship. A hell ship. What was a hell ship? Japan did not use their finest ships, as you can imagine. They took the oldest, rustiest, crappiest ships they could find that had big steel holds in them, and they would take Allied prisoners and drop them down into the bottom. Keep in mind, it's 110 degrees outside. When they dropped you into the bottom, half the men have dysentery, there's hardly any water they lower down, and there are no bathroom facilities to speak of. There's not enough room to sit down. The stories you will read, if you ever choose to do so, about the hell ships, it boggles the mind. Men would regularly lose their minds. Your mind would just simply shatter. This happened all the time. Occasionally, they'll open up the hatch and act like they're going to allow you up. And occasionally, they would allow one or two up. Sometimes it was just a tease, though. Or sometimes they would find pleasure in throwing garbage down on you, peeing on you down below. It's awful. On your hell ship, you eventually get to your next spot. You get out, you breathe free air, you think to yourself, I'm finally home free. Granted, you're sick as a dog, dehydrated beyond belief, and drained. You're drained, and so are your friends. But The Japanese are not going to waste fuel or anything like that getting you where you need to go. Not quite yet. Start marching. You're sick. You're dehydrated. You and your friends, yes, this is, if this sounds like the Bataan Death March, that wasn't the only time this happened. You and everyone you know, you're being marched to a prison camp. It's not 5 miles away. It's 100 miles away. And it's 105 degrees outside. When your friends fall to the wayside and can't get up, the Japanese will bayonet them, shoot them, cut their heads off. The Japanese, if they're driving by in trucks and you happen to stumble in front of the truck, they'll simply drive over you and laugh. They'll walk by you and slap you in the face as hard as they can. Maybe they'll hit you in the back with your buttstock. One of their favorite things to do was they cut off 3 to 4 foot bamboo sticks and hit you every chance they could. You are struggling to survive. Eventually, you find your way to a prison camp, but it's big, and it's just there to get you ready to go to the next place. You see, they're trying to get you into the jungle. We'll continue there in just a moment. Now, let's talk about something great, amazing. Our dogs. It says so much about us as a country that we love our dogs the way we do because they're just such sweet, loyal creatures, aren't they? They just are. They make your day better. So they deserve Rough Greens. Your dog deserves to have not just a longer life, a healthier life. You know, our dogs, they get lethargic, start scratching all the time, digestive system's a mess. This is because they don't have any nutrition. They get dog food that has nothing in it. It's empty calories. It's like you eating fast food every meal. You'd have health problems. Start sprinkling Rough Greens on your dog's food. Packed with all the nutrients your dog needs. It's the number one dog supplement in America for a reason. RoughGreens.com, promo code Jesse, gets you a free Jumpstart trial bag. Or you can call 214-ROUGH-DOG, promo code Jesse. I'll try to finish this next.
This is an iHeart podcast.